From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Work, health, family, retirement. This weekend, Urban Meyer has had people thinking about all of that, people with an interest in college football, especially at the University of Florida. On Saturday, Meyer, who is the incredibly successful head coach of the Florida Gators, announced that he was quitting football at age 45 for health reasons. He said this, "I have ignored my health for years, but recent developments have forced me to reevaluate my priorities of faith and family." Well, then on Sunday, Meyer said instead of quitting, he's taking a leave of absence. What's going on? Well, Jeremy Fowler is the Florida Gators beat writer for the Orlando Sentinel, and he joins us now from New Orleans, where Florida plays the University of Cincinnati Bearcats on Friday in the Sugar Bowl. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
And first, what do we know about those recent developments that Urban Meyer spoke of?
Well, right now, there's still some uncertainty because we don't know all of his future medical proceedings. From what we know, that he's had major chest pains, we don't think he has to have any kind of surgery, but he's taking an indefinite leave of absence. Nothing is really guaranteed at this point whether he will return to the Florida Gators, although his gut feeling is that he will be the coach in 2010. It'll be interesting to see when he's feeling healthy enough to return and if the time off has served his family well.
But it's been about chest pains is what we think?
Yeah, major chest pains, that's for sure. That's brought him to the hospital in Gainesville at least once, from what I've heard, numerous times in the month of December. For chest pains, and you know, there's been rumors and reports that he has collapsed in front of his family before. Nothing with a heart attack, from what Urban Meyer says, but it's been pretty serious, and actually he's had chest pains for numerous years. It just kind of amplified in recent months.
I guess being a big-time college football coach is a pretty demanding job. How would you describe Urban Meyer's mood or attitude when he's coaching the Gators?
Well, he's got that type A personality where it's aggressive, go, go, go all the time. And it's intense for every college coach all across the country that's making big money and they have to produce and try to win for their university. It is high stakes and high pressure, but there has to be a balance of delegation, you know, how you manage your program as opposed to micromanaging it, which a lot of guys do. And maybe Urban Meyer needs to be a little bit more hands-off just to take care of his health because he's obviously gotten in over his head a little bit.
On the other hand, he has been phenomenally successful. How would you measure his success as coach?
He's arguably the brightest college football mind out there. You know, he's revolutionized the offensive game in college football with his spread offense. He's won two national titles and almost a third this year when they lost to Alabama. He's won almost 100 games in nine seasons as a head coach, which is really impressive and pretty unprecedented at this point. So, you know, he's right up there at the top with probably Alabama's Nick Saban and USC's Pete Carroll as the best coaches in college football.
Now, I gather the sports blogosphere, a heartwarming, friendly place that it is, has been ripping into Urban Meyer, calling him a drama queen, an attention hog, all sorts of things.
Yeah, that has been out there, and some criticism is fair, certainly at this point, considering that this has been kind of a PR mess. You know, it maybe could have been handled better. There are just a lot of questions medically about what he's really dealing with. There's something we don't know, and so the public wants to know. Gator Nation, you know, with this coach they have, they want to know about their future and how secure it is. And right now, you can't say that it's 100% secure.
Well, Jeremy Fowler of the Orlando Sentinel, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
We're learning about some American lives in this final week of the year, a few of the people who got us where we are. And this morning we're going to look at a man who shaped this country's economy. Cornelius Vanderbilt owned shipping lines and railroads in the 1800s. His statue still looms over the entrance of New York City's Grand Central Terminal. Biographer T.J. Stiles brought that statue to life.
He was 6 feet tall at a time when the average American man was 5'7 or 5'8. He was combative, living in a level of society that was intensely competitive and confrontational. Rumor and legend has it that he was involved in numerous fistfights, and I actually found court records that showed that he engaged in fistfights and won into his 50s.
T.J. Stiles is the author of The First Tycoon, which won the National Book Award for Nonfiction this year. Cornelius Vanderbilt controlled around 5% of the U.S. economy. That's far more than any individual today. He did that even though he didn't have much education. Cornelius Vanderbilt did not write well or all that often.
His letters are not numerous. He abominated papers, according to his longtime clerk. But those that survive show that he wrote completely phonetically. He would write in this pattern of speech that I didn't find even in other letters from uneducated individuals. I am a-going. Things are a-working. It's really interesting. His lack of education actually allows us to gain access to the way he spoke. But as he aged, even though he never learned to spell properly, his letters became more formal. As he rose in status, he actually sought to become gentlemanly. We see through his letters that he began to inhabit the social world that his wealth lifted him to.
Well, what did he use to begin to vault himself forward in business and in the world?
Well, one of the fascinating things about Vanderbilt is that his career speaks to some of the great themes in American history. And one of them is the expansion of the American economy. Because he was in transportation, transportation was the first big business in America. And as the country geographically shifted, as the economy changed, he shifted his operations to follow the main channel of commerce.
You know, I was delighted as a resident of the East Coast, of the Northeast Corridor, as it's called, who's frequently traveled from New York to Philadelphia to Washington up to Boston by train or by car or by plane, to realize that Vanderbilt based his early fortune on early versions of that Northeast Corridor traffic.
Absolutely. That Northeast Corridor was the main artery of commerce for most of American history until the Civil War. And Vanderbilt followed with his steamboat operations. And he got involved because the early railroads connected with steamboats. He became involved in railroads very early on. And that's interesting not only because he was one of the pioneers in what is still one of the main corridors of commuting today, but because getting involved in the early railroads taught him about corporations. And the emergence of the corporation is one of the major themes of 19th century American history. It's one of the things that created modern America.
You describe businesses were growing too large for any one person to finance or control, and a corporation was a method by which somebody like Cornelius Vanderbilt could take his money and a lot of other people's money and spend it his way.
That's right. The corporation is both an enormously powerful instrument for productivity and the creation of wealth, but it also comes with lots of conflicts of interest. And one of the things about Vanderbilt that's very interesting is that he was a very honest manager of the corporations he ran. And it was considered a wonderfully rare thing. You see the press talking about how amazing it is to have a corporate chieftain who's not stealing from his shareholders.
What was Vanderbilt's attitude toward competition when he was running a steamboat line or a rail line and he had a competitor coming up against him, or he was thinking of competing against somebody?
Well, Vanderbilt made his mark as one of the great competitors. For example, he would go after the big players who were dominating markets. But when he moved into railroads, the railroad industry was different from shipping. If you're competing against someone and you find that you're losing, you can always move your ship somewhere else. But railroads are there to stay. So the man who built his reputation as the great competitor ended his life by helping to forge cartels. He became one of the great anti-competitive forces in the American economy.
You seem to suggest throughout his career, even in shipping, he was perfectly comfortable with monopoly and with no competition as long as it was his monopoly.
But it's interesting because he was perfectly happy to make deals to end competitive wars, either by taking a payment to leave a market or by paying someone else to leave a market.
He would compete and then essentially demand what some people felt was a blackmail payment to stop competing against a rival line.
And that actually led to the first use of the robber baron metaphor. He saw himself as willing and able to fight and win under all circumstances. Whenever he had a monopoly, it was because he'd won it through a fair fight.
Is it too harsh to suggest that Cornelius Vanderbilt's main principle was that he was going to do whatever served his interest in the moment?
No, I don't think that's too harsh at all. One of the most fascinating moments when we see that is in 1867, to settle a dispute with the New York Central Railroad, he decided to cut off all rail traffic into Manhattan, the largest city in the country.
This must have been the equivalent of if you threw a roadblock on Interstate 80 going west out of Manhattan today or something, just cut off traffic.
It would be more like also stopping all airline traffic, also stopping all shipping. Railroads were everything at the time. And it was deep winter. The rivers and the bay were closed by winter storms and ice. So he essentially put a blockade on Manhattan, cutting off the nation's largest city from the rest of the country. Fortunately, the dispute was resolved quickly and Vanderbilt won. His enemies caved in. But it naturally posed a question for Americans, which is, how do we control and make sure that these large corporations, which we so depend upon, how do we make sure that they, in pursuing their private interests, they don't violate the public interest? And when this question was presented to Vanderbilt at a hearing by the New York State Legislature, he said, well, if you can pass a law that gets men to pursue their interests more effectively, then it's all well and good, but I don't think you can do it. He didn't even recognize the idea of a public interest in answering that question. He had the idea taken to the nth degree that society is best served by everyone pursuing their interests as vigorously as possible. And he pursued his personal interests more vigorously than anyone. And he thought that was a great thing for the country.
T.J. Stiles is author of The First Tycoon. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
We're learning about American lives in this final week of the year, a few of the people who got us where we are today. Tomorrow, we will hear about the American life of the boxer Sugar Ray Robinson.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. These days, you can learn just about anything from a YouTube video.
First of all, I'm going to put this bow around his neck.
A South Carolina man teaches us how to tie a bow tie. His YouTube video has been viewed more than 650,000 times. Or maybe you've always wanted to learn how to play the piano.
Let's make this thing minor, shall we? We take the middle finger and move it down a half step to the F.
Today on All Tech Considered, we're going to talk with a man who is devoting his life to creating YouTube tutorials.
Welcome to the presentation on multiplying fractions. Today, you'll be very happy because you'll find out that this is one of the few times where multiplying something is easier than adding it. And if you don't believe me, let's do some problems.
That is Salman Khan, not the Salman Khan who's a Bollywood star. This is the Salman Khan, former hedge fund analyst turned online tutor. He has produced more than 1,000 YouTube videos ranging from basic multiplication of fractions to polynomial approximation of functions. And he joins us now from Silicon Valley in California. Welcome.
Thanks.
Your channel on YouTube is called the Khan Academy channel. Why did you decide to become a tutor online?
It happened fairly organically. I started remotely tutoring some of my cousins in New Orleans. I was working, as you mentioned, as a hedge fund analyst in Boston at the time. My cousin Nadia was having trouble placing into the pre-algebra class. So I talked to Nadia a little bit and I said, how about you and me do some remote tutoring after I come home from work and you come home from school? We'll get a conference call going and maybe we'll use Instant Messenger or we'll find something else. We ended up using Yahoo Doodle, and word got around amongst friends and family, and I had a little cohort of about 10 or 15 students. And then it just became difficult logistically between my work and their soccer practice. So, and I had to keep tutoring the same lessons over and over again, depending on how old they were. So I decided to just record my lessons, but in the same style that I was doing with Nadia that seemed to be effective. And I started just recording them and putting them on YouTube. And even your, my great-great-grandkids could learn from these same videos.
Now, I've watched a few of them. You never appear on screen, just a mouse arrow that draws in different colors on a black background, and you narrate. How are you actually making these?
When I started, it was literally I took Microsoft Paint, made the background black, picked some fluorescent colors, and I used this shareware, I think it was called Screen Video Recorder. It was a $20 piece of software to capture my screen and to record my voice at the same time, and that would just produce the videos. I just did it because that was, I thought, the cheapest and fastest way to make a decent quality video. Since then, one of the viewers actually donated a $300 piece of software called Camtasia Recorder for the screen capture, and now I use another piece of shareware called Smooth Draw 2, I think it's called. I use that to draw, and I just have a little Wacom graphic pen tablet to do the writing.
Now, let's go through some of the range of what you are doing tutorials in mathematics and chemistry, biology.
Yeah, and this non-sciences, there's obviously a lot on finance and economics. Actually, a lot of that comes from last year during the financial crisis. In my hedge fund world, I put all my money in cash and I started reading the Federal Reserve Act. I read it about 10 times just to understand all of the levers that the Federal Reserve chairman could pull. And I said, well, what's a better use of my time than whatever I just learned? Let me make a series of YouTube videos on fractional reserve banking and the Federal Reserve. And I don't plan on limiting myself to just the maths and the sciences.
Now, here's something I noticed while watching a tutorial you were giving about stocks. You were, I think, making the point that a stock that costs $1 a share is not necessarily cheaper than a stock that costs $10 a share. As I'm watching it, a crawl comes across the bottom from Google directing me to a website where I can look over the prospectus for various penny stocks. It's an advertisement, and indeed the
right.
advertisement is actually based on a proposition that you're shooting down in the course of the tutorial. First of all, who's advertising? How many of your courses are advertised? And how do you feel about this kind of education being underwritten by a sponsor?
The advertising is what YouTube puts up just by virtue of it being on YouTube. I do share some of the revenue. It's pushing about $1,500 of revenue to Khan Academy, Inc., which is a 501c3 not-for-profit organization. So it's going to the organization right now. It's not coming to me as a salary in any way right now.
Without the advertising, are you, I mean, I know you were working for a hedge fund before, but are you, is this self-sustaining? Can you support this as a career doing it based on people free of charge looking at videos?
Well, right now it isn't self-sustaining as of today. I joke that it's being funded by the Salman Khan Bank of America checking account. My wife has given me a year to make it self-sustaining, although I think she'll be giving me a little more leeway than that. If I get no outside support, there are the donations that are coming in from the viewers themselves. That's bringing in about $1,500 a month. I have these kind of low-key ads that you mentioned that are just off of YouTube. If I were to be aggressive with the advertising, which I don't want to do, I could probably generate another few thousand dollars a month. And at the rate that the viewership is growing, it's growing at about 15 or 20% per month. I'm reasonably confident that in about a year, the site itself could pay my rent and put food on the table.
Are you a faculty of one at the Khan Academy?
I currently am. There are people who have come out of the woodworks really in the last 2 months or so to volunteer translating the videos. There's a chemistry teacher in Uruguay who did the first translation. There's an effort going on to translate into Arabic, into Polish, into Portuguese, into German. But right now, all of the content is and has been generated by me.
You come across in these videos as a very natural teacher. And I wonder, on the way through MIT and Harvard Business School and hedge fund trade, did you ever just consider becoming a teacher?
I actually was a teacher for just to make some extra cash during college. I was an MCAT instructor for the Princeton Review for one summer, and I used to volunteer teaching middle school kids at the Devotion School in Brookline. It's something that I really enjoy, but the economics of the hedge fund world were a little bit better.
You could have done a very simple tutorial on the difference between the pay of a hedge fund analyst and a teacher. When you're teaching online, there's not a real-time exchange with the students, and their comments to you aren't coming back in real time. Do you think that would be an added virtue of education? Or does it matter that much?
I think that this is an advantage I have over a traditional teacher. Just from my limited experience from teaching live, one of the hardest things is to sit in front of a classroom of 20 or 30 students, and maybe five of them are giving you a nice attentive expression, and the rest of them have blank faces. You don't know if they're bored or they're falling behind, and it makes you insecure, and you don't know what to do next. But I go to my computer, spend 10 minutes, explain something as I would explain it to you or my cousin, and then I upload it on YouTube. The whole process takes maybe half an hour, and within an hour of putting up a video, a few hundred people will watch it, and I wait for them to give that YouTube five-star rating and put a couple of comments up saying, oh, this is so great, I was going to fail this class, now I'm going to pass the exam tomorrow or whatever else. So I wait for that feedback, and that gives me the confidence to keep going.
Salman Khan, who teaches math, science, finance, and much more at Khan, K-H-A-N, Academy.org. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. We're reporting next on the side effects of our mass media. Every year we get a little bit closer to a world where you get what you want when you want it, at least when it comes to entertainment. New technologies have given us access to countless channels for music and television and film. But NPR's Laura Seidel wonders whether convenience is costing us a sense of common culture.
Remember the Seinfeld episode when a reporter mistakenly thought that Jerry and George were lovers?
We knew you were eavesdropping. That's why my friend said all that. It was on purpose. We're not gay. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
And not that there's anything wrong with it if you didn't see the episode or any of the other famous ones, you know, yada, yada, yada.
Even if you didn't see them, you knew about them.
That's Clifford Nass, Stanford University communications professor. He says Seinfeld, a show about nothing, actually meant something. Americans laughed together.
That's really what marks cultural touchstones, things that people are aware of, that they can share, that they can make reference to, that they don't actually have to consume themselves.
More than 40% of American households saw the final episode of Seinfeld in the spring of 1998, according to the Nielsen Company. Fast forward about 11 years.
The winner of American Idol 2009 is Chris Allen!
You can be forgiven if you have no idea who Chris Allen is. American Idol may be the most popular program on television today, but only about 16% of American households saw this year's finale. Over the last decade, the number of television channels has more than doubled. There's Lifetime for women, Spike for men, the Sci-Fi Channel, and onto that, the internet and YouTube. Professor Abigail Dukosnik with UC Berkeley's Center for New Media says once the nation shared trusted anchors like Walter Cronkite and Peter Jennings, now everyone can find the news that suits their taste.
Fox News will take a stance that represents a certain set of values, and The Daily Show will take a stance that has a very different ideology than Fox News. For better or for worse, when we did have 60 million people watching any one network's nightly news program, that meant that 60 million people had to all receive the same information and make up their minds about it and be in dialogue with one another about it.
Dukosnik says people watch the news they find agreeable, and then they use the internet to chat with the people who share their tastes and opinions. Stanford professor Clifford Nass says social scientists find the current trends worrisome.
There have never been cultures or societies in which there weren't a very large set of shared ideas, norms, values, stories, cultures, etc. We've just never seen that before.
Of course, having a mainstream culture also meant that some people felt left out.
I'm Kenna Fung, and I'm kind of a nerd.
A science fiction nerd. Fung particularly loves the BBC program Doctor Who, which airs on cable in the U.S. Doctor Who is an alien who travels through time and space. He often visits Earth.
I'm the Doctor, by the way.
Astrid, sir. Astrid Pith.
Nice to meet you, Astrid. Merry Christmas.
Doctor Who didn't interest anyone else in school, says Fung.
Even though I know they had a lot of viewers across the world and across the country, nobody at school was really into it, and so I felt like I was the only one who liked that, and I had nobody to talk about it with.
At least not in person. But she did meet people through online fan sites.
How have you been?
I've been fine, thanks.
Fung met Mary Bister online. The two of them have never met in person. I suggested Fung give her a ring, and they had no problem launching into a conversation about the new actor who will play Doctor Who.
I can't wait to see if Matt Smith has any weird facial expressions just like David Tennant did.
Well, don't you think he has to with that face?
In the real world, this friendship between 35-year-old Bister, a medical student at the University of Chicago, and 19-year-old Fung, a community college student in San Mateo, would be unlikely.
I don't have a whole lot of young adults, late teens, early 20s friends, but in the Doctor Who fandom, that's a big percentage of who's there.
Clearly, these kinds of connections cross bridges between people in ways that watching Seinfeld or the evening news at home never could. But Stanford professor Clifford Nass says they're not likely to hold a nation together.
The things that tend to glue society together are people who share a number of things together. It makes it easier to mobilize, to bring people together behind a cause, behind an issue.
Like healthcare or war. There were decades when if you hadn't heard of certain cultural touchstones like Seinfeld or Michael Jackson, you might be considered to be living under a rock. But as technology lets each of us indulge our personal desires and tastes, we now can crawl under our own rocks. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
The first holiday retail sales numbers are in, and they are better than many expected. Spending Pulse, a unit of MasterCard, estimates that sales were up more than 3.5% over last year. But retailers aren't celebrating, at least not yet. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
First, the good news. If you go back to last year, holiday retail spending was in free fall. This year, says Michael McNamara of MasterCard Advisors, it has stabilized.
The good thing about that is that the inventory situation for retailers was more aligned with demand. So they burned through their inventory, so you're going to have to replenish those. That's generally a positive thing. So generally, even though the numbers might not be huge in terms of sales, it's a much healthier season this year compared to a year ago.
But keep in mind, 2008 was the worst holiday season in four decades. And McNamara points out that an extra shopping day between Thanksgiving and Christmas may have helped boost sales over last year. Online sales were especially strong in 2009. And McNamara says there were two factors at work.
One is the ongoing migration from brick-and-mortar location shopping to online shopping. The other is the fact that we had several winter storms this season.
Amazon.com said on December 14th, its peak day of the season, shoppers worldwide ordered 9.5 million items. That works out to 110 items per second. They ordered lots and lots of Amazon's electronic book reader, the Kindle, and on Christmas Day, for the first time ever, shoppers bought more e-books than physical books. Consumer electronics sold well online and off, so did footwear, probably boots because of the nasty weather, and jewelry.
The fact that jewelry was up 5.6% versus last year absolutely astounded me.
Patricia Edwards is a retail analyst at Storehouse Partners. She says the number was especially surprising because no one seemed to be shopping in mall jewelry stores.
Now, part of that is, I'm sure, due to the fact that the price of gold is way up this year versus last year. But it also signifies to me that the high-end consumer is truly back and that they were feeling a little bit better and spending on things that would last for their significant others.
Still, with unemployment above 10% nationwide, spending isn't likely to return to pre-recession levels for a while. And despite the encouraging numbers for MasterCard, the National Retail Federation's Kathy Grana says the trade group is sticking with its original forecast, down 1% from last year. Still, she says,
We are hearing reports of so-called frugal fatigue, where people are taking advantage of these sales and bargains and treating themselves to something that they may not have bought all year long.
Hard numbers from the Commerce Department and retailers themselves won't be out till the middle of January. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
Airlines have also suffered this year, and last Friday's attempted jetliner bombing doesn't help. Most of the major carriers saw their stock prices fall yesterday. The fear is that increased security and a general sense of unease could make travelers less willing to fly. NPR's Wade Goodwin has the view from one of the country's busiest airports, Dallas-Fort Worth.
If there are long lines at some Canadian airports for U.S.-bound travelers, at DFW's International Terminal, all is quiet on the Western Front.
Please help us ensure your safety while visiting the Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport.
Passengers are walking straight to the counter at American Airlines, grabbing their tickets and winding their way through the security maze and right up to the X-ray machine as sunlight pours into the terminal out of a stunningly blue sky. Hector Gonzalez is a service engineer for a German company that makes X-ray equipment. Although he often travels on business, today he's going with his wife to San Juan, Puerto Rico. He, for one, is chagrined that an accused terrorist that U.S. authorities had been warned about had nevertheless managed to slip bomb-making material on board a U.S. aircraft.
Appalled that all the safety measures and all the precautions that we're taking lately still allow for such a thing to happen.
If Gonzalez is dismayed at this federal dropping of the ball, he is not, however, afraid to get on board his airplane.
Frankly, I'm really not concerned. I've seen the security. I feel quite safe.
The alleged attempt to blow Northwest Flight 253 out of the sky over Detroit failed. The suspect was arrested, and for many, if not most, of the flying public, life goes on, as Glenn Smith waited at baggage claim for his college-age daughter to return home for her Christmas break. He said one had to be realistic.
People are trying to kill us, and I don't think there's anything you can do to stop 100% of them. You know, what can you do? Somebody's paying you to go somewhere, you got to go.
Many airline CEOs believe they are just now seeing light at the end of the tunnel, unless, of course, this incident kills their international business travel. Robert W. Mann Jr. is one of the country's leading airline industry consultants. Mann says fear is not the issue, inconvenience is.
Even for a trip of 6 hours, like London, New York, the idea that you would lose 3 hours on each end of the trip makes it questionable.
If international airport security tightens the screws and extends delays, they may damage their slowly rebounding airline industry and their economies. It is too early to tell. Not until the first full week after the holidays are over will the airline industry have any sense of where things stand. Mann says he is pleased that the Obama administration is conducting a top-to-bottom review of the TSA and its security processes, which he believes have largely been a failure.
And I would go further to say that I'd like to see the next $1 billion invested in, not in technology with x-rays and puffer machines, but rather essentially police work done offshore to locate people who would do harm, whoever they may be, wherever they may be, and before they ever get to an airport. Airport is a particularly bad last line of defense for any kind of process like this.
Mann is not worried about the next would-be terrorist trying to conduct another ill-conceived and hastily attempted chemistry experiment on board an aircraft. He frets about the soft underbelly of the nation's airports, with their long lines of tightly clustered people waiting together to go through security and into the safe side of the terminal. He knows more puffer machines will not stop suicide bombers wrapped in vests of C4 plastique. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Dallas.